Welcome to the Razor's Ink podcast with your host, Jonathan Farini. Three films from three different decades, different plots, but all with a common theme: men for sale. Pour yourself a drink, pull up a chair, and hear Jonathan's take on movies, television, and today, three twists on the world's oldest profession. Here's your host, Jonathan Farini.
There are many films about female prostitutes. The exchange is straightforward. The client pays money in exchange for sex. The amount of time spent, as well as the services rendered, determine the price. Inside legit film, the subject of men selling themselves to women isn't so straightforward. All of you fellows have probably learned by now women don't have to pay for sex. But when women want the company of a special man, what are they looking for? What consideration is rendered by women to choose these male escorts? Where can we explore the men for sale theme inside film, Jonathan? Let's examine. Imagine you're a struggling Hollywood screenwriter behind in your rent and attempting to outrun the repo guys chasing you to get your car, whose payments are in arrears. You pick up a flat tire, pull inside a stately mansion which is in need of a makeover. You hide your car inside a garage. A voice calls out to you from a window above, and you meet the owner of the mansion.
You there! Why are you so late? Why have you kept me waiting so long?
When she discovers you're a writer, you're offered room and board in exchange for writing a script for her comeback movie after decades of being relegated as a washed-up silent film actress.
I warn you, don't give me a fancy price just because I'm rich.
Lady, you got the wrong man. I had some trouble with my car, flat tire. I pulled into your garage until I could get a spare. I thought this was an empty house.
It is not. Get out.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry you lost your friend. And I don't think red is the right color. Wait a minute, haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures, used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
You work from the mansion, attended to by her butler, who you later discover was her first husband, and a film director who discovered the actress, making her a star. You're provided a new wardrobe from the best stores in town, and caviar and champagne always are on the ready. In exchange for this upgraded standard of living at no charge, your duties also include companionship.
Two or three times a week, Max would haul up that enormous oil painting that had been presented to her by some Nevada Chamber of Commerce. And we'd see a movie, right in her living room. So much nicer than going out, she'd say. The plain fact was she was afraid of that world outside. Afraid it would remind her that time had passed. They were silent movies, and Max would run the projection machine, which was just as well. It kept him from giving us an accompaniment on that wheezing organ. She'd sit very close to me, and she'd smell of tube roses, which is not my favorite perfume, not by a long shot. Sometimes, as we watched, she'd clutch my arm or my hand, forgetting she was my employer, just becoming a fan, excited about that actress up there on the screen. I guess I don't have to tell you who the star was. They were always her pictures. That's all she wanted to see.
But you find yourself feeling like a prisoner in the mansion. You miss your peers toiling away inside movie studios. To complicate matters, you cultivate a romance with a script reader for a studio. Your employer, so to speak, has developed a romantic attachment with you, and it's become too heavy. And because you have ethics, you bring the girlfriend to the mansion to see why you've been living above your means. You reject the sweetheart, sending her brokenhearted into the night. Pack a bag and walk into an uncertain future, which includes being shot in the back and murdered by your client. You do, however, take a final swim within the pool, face down. Not for you. Here's another scenario. You're a young, hard-bodied stud, likely working as a busboy, beach boy, or bartender, who wants his big break at stardom in Hollywood. You befriend an aged actress who is running away from Hollywood in disgrace after a terrible opening night of her comeback film. You become her personal attendant, which includes driving her Cadillac as far away from Hollywood as possible and providing companionship of all forms during the journey.
I had my picture on the cover of Life magazine. Oh, whoa!
And at the same time, I was employing my other talent, lovemaking.
That may be the only talent you ever truly meant for.
You convince her to sign your personal service contract and secretly record her speaking about her booze, pills, and hashish indulgences to assure she will make the necessary Hollywood contacts for you. You mistakenly believe your contract is ironclad. What's the deal? You will contact famous Hollywood columnists eager to speak with the star. And of course, she'll mention her finding a young man with big star potential. You.
I can get out of that contract anytime I want to. Do you have any talent?
For what?
Acting, baby. Acting. A contract for acting implies that you are an actor, are you?
Look, I've been an extra in movies long enough to know that I can be as big a star as some of them she-men that have made it. Princess? Princess? All I need is just one big break.
Oh, Carl, it takes
one break,
Carl.
Chance, Wayne, you're stoned.
Baby, there is no easy way to the top. Now, forget about magic formulas and trick contracts. Forget about this false dream.
Okay, come on, say it, Princess. What is it you want?
Come here. Let's comfort each other a little.
You also want to show off to the folks back home in the small Florida town on the Gulf what a big shot you've become as the personal assistant to the actress whose name is barely recognizable. You had previously been run out of this small town for knocking up the daughter of the big shot politician, whose wrath you incur. You resort to blackmail by threatening to release the tapes, which convinces your client to take the call from the famous columnist who convinces her to return to Hollywood.
It's Walter Winchell in Hollywood.
Oh, no. They want me? They really want me? For what part? Who wants me?
Come on, talk to him about me.
Oh, Walter.
Me.
The actress resents your hustle and offers you a job as a chauffeur and toy boy, but cautions you'll only be around as long as you're lean, handsome, and young. You decline, and she kicks you to the curb, departing for Hollywood.
I know you're going to do this for me, Princess, because I have been knocking on those doors of success till my insides are bloody. Because that's the way I've been knocking on those doors, see, with my bare insides.
You will open only one door, the door to my car as my chauffeur. You will wake me in the morning as my butler or my lover, depending on what I want. In a few years, you will be through with your good looks, and I will be through with you. And that is the truth. Can you face the truth? Are you ready to be my chauffeur, my next Franz Albersart?
Don't you know I would die first? I would. I would rather die first.
The final payment for all your work is having the goons working for the big shot politician whose daughter you knocked up, busting your face apart, marring your good looks, which has been your meal ticket, as one of the attackers remarks. Does it appeal to you? Try this gig. You're young enough but old enough to have the necessary savoir-faire to become a paid escort to wealthy older women who order your services through a beautiful lady pimp who taught you the finer points of catering to women's sensibilities. What's the deal? You act as a tour guide, chauffeur, dinner companion, when desired, provide sexual services. You own a beautiful wardrobe, convertible German sports car, but you're so good at your trade, you've become independent, demanding a larger percentage of the fee, and this is pissing off your lady pimp and a shady male pimp for whom you've performed tricks within the dark.
You made quite a hit in Palm Springs. They want you back. I'm serious. I want you to come back this week. I wouldn't take much, you know. It's they're regulars for me.
You lied to me, Leon. It was a rough trick.
Oh, I forgot you got scruples now, huh?
Well, here you go. I don't like playing the same numbers too often. They get possessive. What? I can't be possessed.
She's supposed to be different.
Absolutely. That include Miss Anne?
Then who?
Well, I don't know why you fool around with that dumb bitch.
I'll tell you why, Leon. She's got a job coming up for me in a week. It's $8,000. Can you get me that?
Just trying to warn you, that's all. I mean, that bitch will sell you out.
But you really care about me, don't you? Don't you, Leon? You care.
You know, you walk an awful thin line, Julie. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes. I mean, you're getting awful cocky.
Kinky realms of your profession. Sound pretty good so far, fellas? It gets better. You've made the acquaintance of the wife of a powerful politician who is both beautiful and loving. You're falling for her and she for you. It looks like the perfect retirement package and golden parachute. The shady male pimp has a threesome go bad with one of his boys, and he decides to set you up for the murder with no alibi. Not so good after all, huh? Let's discuss the three scenarios I summarized for you. The first was the premise of the 1950 Paramount film Sunset Boulevard, starring William Holden, Gloria Swanson, and Eric von Stroheim, including cameos by Cecil B. DeMille, Hedda Hopper, and Buster Keaton playing themselves. 11 Oscar nominations, winning 3 for Best Story and Screenplay, Best Art Direction, and Best Score. It's within the National Film Registry and included within the American Film Institute's 100 Best American Films of the 20th Century. Note the terrific opening credits with a curbstone marked Sunset Boulevard in the very first frame. See my podcast. Opening titles and closing credits are the prologues and epilogues of visual media. I got goosebumps with this opening credit. I deliberately referenced Curb earlier in homage. Catch it? Gloria Swanson plays Norma Desmond, who is 50. Gloria was 51 at the time. I watched this film recently and find her gorgeous. 50 is the new 40, and women today at 50 combine beauty with wisdom. Today, in Hollywood, as was the case for Norma, scripts seem to become scarce as actresses age. It's a sad fact. See my podcast, Ageism and Actresses. Holden plays screenwriter Joe Gillis. Joe can't pay the bills writing scripts, so he becomes a live-in writer muse to Norma Desmond.
Here. I was going to give it to you at midnight.
Norma, I can't take it. You bought me enough.
Shut up. I'm rich. I'm richer than all this new Hollywood trash. I've got $1 million.
Keep it.
I own 3 blocks downtown. I've got oil and Bakersfield. Pumping, pumping, pumping. What's it for but to buy us anything we want?
Cut out that us business.
What's the matter with you?
What right do you have to take me for granted?
What right? You want me to tell you?
Has it ever occurred to you that I may have a life of my own, that there may be some girl that I'm crazy about?
Who? Some car hop or dress extra?
What I'm trying to say is that I'm all wrong for you. You want a Valentino, somebody with polo ponies, a big shot.
What you're trying to say is you don't want me to love you. Say it. Say it.
Holden would have been 32 in 1950, so Joe Gillis is running out of time to make it as a writer, and he's scared. Time isn't kind, at least professionally, to men. Ask any guy 50 or over seeking work. Joe falls in love. Joe has ethics and quits both Norma and Nancy, the scriptwriter. I think it's a metaphor. He's given up on his writing career, and death, I contend, is better than selling cars, real estate, or tending bar for a washed-up Hollywood writer. Look for a young Jack Webb playing a minor role as one of Joe's Hollywood writer chums, Artie. He became one of the most prolific producers in television history, making the cover of Time magazine. See my podcast about Jack Webb.
What is this, Mink? Judas H. Priest? Who did you borrow that from? Adolph Monju?
Close, but no cigar.
Say, you're not really in the smuggling business these days, are you?
Where's the bar? Oh.
Artie loses the girl to Joe. The second gig I described was the premise of Sweet Bird of Youth, released by MGM in 1962, directed and written by Richard Brooks, and starring Paul Newman and Geraldine Page, who would have been only 38 years old and aptly playing an older woman. Paul was 37, playing a younger man, say 20-something. I can't help think of the beautiful Anne Bancroft, who was 36, playing Mrs. Robinson. Dustin Hoffman was 30 years old. we're told Benjamin is 21. Do you see a trend here? Actresses playing older and actors playing younger. Look for beautiful opening credits coming at you like a breeze off the Gulf and a ride down an oceanfront highway inside a Cadillac convertible. Life is sweet like the ocean breeze, and we have no idea what carnage is about to play out, just like the opening credits of Sunset Boulevard. Paul plays a character named Chance. The name is too obvious because his name is the end game he seeks, a chance. The screenplay was adapted from the play by Tennessee Williams by director and screenwriter Richard Brooks. Sweet Bird of Youth was actually two plays released in 1956. The screenplay adaptation of Sweet Bird of Youth doesn't measure up to Tennessee's other adapted works. The characters inside the screenplay are shallow and lack the depth of Tennessee's characters inside Streetcar Named Desire, Suddenly Last Summer, and Night of the Iguana, to name a few of Tennessee's plays. The film was released only 12 years after Sunset Boulevard, and eerily similar in plot. Nothing happens in film by accident, is a maxim of this podcast. Chance becomes a chauffeur, drug dealer, and doormat for his actress employer, Alexandra Del Lago, if she will give him his big break in Hollywood to become a star. Chance enables Alexandra to escape Hollywood by returning to his hometown, which is on the Florida Gulf. They check into a hotel inside this town because Chance wants to get back the girlfriend from his youth named Heavenly. Yes, I said Heavenly, who resides in this small Gulf town. Tennessee is a master of titles. Streetcar Named Desire, The Glass Menagerie, Suddenly Last Summer, Night of the Iguana, and Sweet Bird of Youth. So why name the characters Chance and Heavenly Tennessee? Is the playwright being purposely obvious, or is he alluding to possibly a heavenly chance, or a chance found only in heaven? I'll ask him during my fantasy five-minute discussion and get back to you. Chance can't break into Hollywood and get his heavenly back. He's faced with a choice, like Holden's Joe, and walks out on Alexandra Del Lago, a shot at Hollywood, and into the cane in the face, destroying his beauty, his meal ticket.
Heavenly! Don't you ever speak the name of my sister again. Heavenly! Heavenly! Don't you know?
Kill him.
No. It's gonna take away Lover Boy's meal ticket. Put him down there. Chance? Bring him over here. Look at yourself. No woman will ever again pay to love that.
With respect to Joe and Chance, we might ask, which is worse, death or disfigurement? For Chance, Heavenly bests Hollywood. And the film ends with the presumption the two will be reunited. I know some who may choose Hollywood over heaven. Just saying. Sweet Bird of Youth won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for Ed Begley playing the big shot politician. The third scenario is the 1980 American Gigolo starring Richard Gere and Lauren Hutton, released by Paramount. Gere was 31 and Hutton was 37, but is playing older, like Geraldine and Gloria. I contend Hutton was made up to look older than 37. The opening credits are very stylish, including Blondie singing Call Me. We know who and what he does by the time the opening credits are finished. Julian looks to be 30 tops, but time isn't on his side and stokes his ambitious independence, saying, I have to keep on moving. It's a metaphor screaming, youth is fleeting for a guy in your profession, Julian. Time was fleeting for Joe and Chance as well. Julian prefers servicing wealthy older women clients, but doesn't do kink. See my podcast about American Gigolo. Having a pimp who procures within the gay world suggests that Julian is lying or has internal conflicts. Lauren Hutton plays Michelle, who wins Julian's heart, like Heavenly won Chance's. She gains entry into his very private bachelor pad. This is a very strong and, to me, a metaphor piercing Julian's professional veneer and heart.
I'm Michelle.
Bonsoir. How did you find me?
It wasn't hard. Are you surprised?
What do you want?
I would have thought that you'd live in a place with thick red carpet, big circular bed, mirrors on the ceiling.
Bordello. This is my apartment. Women don't come here.
It's love which wins the day because Michelle throws away marriage to a successful politician to become Julian's alibi in a murder rap. The film ends with the belief the two will become united. American Gigolo is flawed, so not much more to discuss here. Listen to my podcast where I dissect it. It could have been a great movie if it was honest about Julian. Here's my takeaways about Men for Sale in film. Norma Alexandra and Michelle demanded more than sex. They're seeking companionship, validation they are beautiful and worthy of a handsome man, an escort, dinner date, but sex isn't primary. Joe Chance and Julian are running from time right on their heels. Good looks and talent won't last forever. They're all eager to make it to the top before it's too late. See my podcast, Time and Motion Pictures. A hustle as a male escort doesn't mix with having a loving girlfriend. You can't have both. Retirement for these men is harsh, which includes losing your good looks, replacement by a newer model, so to speak, murder, disfigurement, or prison. How did the job descriptions sound, fellas? Which would you choose? Out of the three Men for Sale films we discussed, I'd pick Julian's. I suspect I have many in agreement. Until I see you next time, please leave behind a soft footprint and class is dismissed.
Well, given how things turned out for Holden and Newman, yeah, not too much of a choice there, Jonathan. You've been listening to the Razor's Ink podcast with Jonathan Farini. Be sure to check out Jonathan's collection of fiction at the Jonathan B. Farini Story Collection at jonathanfarini.com. There you'll find everything from drama to romance, something for every reader, including his short story, The Note Inside the Nook, published in this month's edition of Mobius Magazine. That's jonathanfarini.com, Farini with two R's, one N. Or drop an email to razorsincpodcast@gmail.com.